You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this month to talk about Limited Collector's Edition number C35, starring Shazam, the world's mightiest mortal, is my pal, Chuck Dill. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, Rob. How's it going?
It's going great. Thank you so much for being on the show. You and I have been online friends for a long time. You were a member, an early member of Foam, the Friends of Aquaman distinction that I gave people back on my old Aquaman Shrine blog. But we've never actually had a chance to podcast again, so this is really cool. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, I've been stalking you for a while, listening to all the podcasts, enjoyed your book, the whole deal. So yeah, finally said, you know what, I want in on this.
Very cool. All right. Well, like I said, I hope you enjoy the experience. You don't come back regretting, like, why did I reach out to that guy? Would have been better just to stalk him. So, as I said, we're going to be talking about Limited Collector's Edition number C35 starring Shazam. But before we get to that really fun comic, Chuck, like, what is your history with the Treasury format?
Oh, man. So, Treasuries were Christmas for me. I read comics early on. I guess that's some of my earliest memories for reading. But Treasuries were sticking out of my Christmas stocking in 1974, 75, and 76. So it was always a big deal. Those were the ones I kept. My family was in the Air Force. We moved a lot. My mother would throw away a lot of my toys, including my Migos, my 16.
Oh, Mom! No!
She'd clean out all the coverless comics I had and just trimmed down, but the Treasuries always survived every Air Force move, so those were good.
Now that's really interesting. Now I wonder, is it because of the price point? Like your mom, you know, if your mom was going to drop a dollar on a book that obviously had a slightly more, you know, hefty permanent feel to it.
I don't know. It may have been how much I loved them. I remember we lived in Texas at one point, and there was a tornado, and my mother brought us all into the central closet of the whole house to keep us safe. And I brought Treasuries for everyone, thinking that that was the thing to do. That was
That's marvelous.
And for my father, who, you know, hates comics and was very serious and all that, I thought I would win him over with the Marvel Treasury Edition, Fantastic Four, Jack Kirby artwork.
I love this story. I love the kid logic of it. While we get to the tornado, everybody, please enjoy Dick Tracy. You know, I just love that idea. That's great. Now, I have to ask, you said these Treasuries were in your stocking. Was your stocking really wide, or were these books folded up?
They were rolled. They would be half rolled.
Oh no. Oh geez. So okay, well, did you have particular favorites? You know, I mean, you must have, right? Which ones were the, you know, I mean, you love the format, but I mean, did you have ones that you were particularly read more than the other ones?
That Fantastic Four one and the Jack Kirby artwork in it really kind of spoke to me. And and I've always been DC guy, and except for the Fantastic Four, I just kind of dragged them in, and I'm like, these are the most, Reed is the most DC character that Marvel has.
That's interesting. I'd have to think about that, but yeah, it's an interesting observation. Yeah. And he's got a big-headed scientist guy, very, very steadfast. Yeah, he would have fit in quite well in like DC 50s continuity.
Yeah. And there was even a point where I picked up the Christmas Digest in the 80s, DC Christmas Digest, and there was a Sandman story in there with Kirby artwork. Well, I had never seen DC Kirby artwork, but I recognized it, the style from that Treasury. Mm-hmm. And I went around to my friend and said, hey, can you tell whether this is DC or Marvel just by looking at the artwork? And my friend was like, get out of here, nerd. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, no. Oh. Well, I mean, not to reveal secrets, but I will say, everybody, I got a glimpse at the room that Chuck is in as he's recording this, and it looks like a toy store. It just looks like Chuck is living inside of a toy store. So I would say, despite all that, you know, pushback you got as a child, you won, man. You won. You got the last laugh, because I mean, your collection is I'm in awe of it. I don't know what else to say about it.
It's nice. I'm actually sitting here with the Phantom Stranger Figures Toy Company Mego like doll. I know you're a big fan.
I love that guy. So now, have you gone and gotten more of the Treasuries like since? Like, you filled holes in your collection and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Throughout the 90s and 2000s, I was raking in the physical comics hand over fist. Picked up every Treasury I could get my hands on. And I think my collection is pretty complete. If I'm missing stuff, it's on the Marvel side. I definitely scooped up every DC one that I could get my hands on.
Gotcha. Yeah, that was a good time to do it, you know, because like right now they're going through the roof. But yeah, the 90s and the 2000s, they were still kind of like, nobody wants these. So you could get them cheaply. Well, that's amazing. I love the idea of you bringing Treasuries into the safe room. Here, everybody. You want to read old Golden Age artwork starring the Flash? Here you go. Yeah. Oh, my God. That's great. I love kid logic like that.
Every Christmas, I bring out the four Christmas Treasuries and display them in my little... I have a Christmas spot where I put up, like, superhero ornaments and the DC Funko Pops that are Christmas-themed. And the backdrop to that is the DC and Marvel Christmas Treasuries.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. Now, are any other members of your family into this stuff at all? Or are you kind of, is this like your little toy cave and you're the only one that goes in there?
Well, my youngest son, who's now 16, he's taken up the mantle and he's high into it. But the Marvel movies have swayed him. He's another Marvel guy just because the movies have such a strong presence in today's culture. But yeah. I can make him read. He's got a reading iPad that I've disabled all kinds of video games or anything like that off of that. All internet and take all his devices and go read some.
Very good. Yeah, I still say that, you know, I think Marvel and the other companies are really missing a bet not publishing. I mean, I know that I have this theory because I want it to be true, and that's probably a good chunk of it. But I really think that, like, if Marvel put out Treasury editions of their movie characters and got those sold in, like, Target, they'd make some money on these. Because these are globally recognized icons now. And you can't put them in comic book stores because kids still aren't really going to comic book stores. But I think if you rack them with the toys, like, you know, like a Guardian, they did a Guardians of the Galaxy Treasury not that long ago. But I don't know why there isn't, like, a Doctor Strange Treasury. I know there's some financial realities of getting shelf space in stores, and it's not just a matter of snapping your fingers and making it happen. But I mean, good Lord, Marvel and DC have what, 60, 70 years of material to cull from and just reprint. I mean, they got to pay reprint rights. They didn't used to be able to have to do that. But still, I just think, you know, with how many movies they're cranking out, both companies, it just feels like a no-brainer, but I don't know. It doesn't seem to happen.
And they have enough pull now, you'd think they'd be able to get them into the theaters.
That too, yeah. You imagine that if you were kids leaving the theater and seeing like a $10 Treasury edition of the characters they just saw, that would be amazing. I mean, you know, relevant to what we're going to be discussing, there's a Shazam movie coming out this year. Yes. It would be awesome to have a Shazam Treasury. You know, and you would think movie theaters would be all over that because you cut them in on it. They need the money, you know. I mean, I don't know. I've read some things here and there about why, the sort of economic realities of why that doesn't happen. But, you know, I still think, like, I don't know, you could if you really wanted to. I really think they're missing a bet on this stuff. So, as I said, let's talk about Shazam a little bit before we get to the comic. I'm assuming you and I are probably around the same age. I'm assuming that you watched the Filmation show, every kid of your generation. I just watched it till my eyes fell out of my head because it was a live action superhero on television. Yeah. You hardly ever got to see that outside of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. But that was so awesome. So I imagine you were a big fan of it.
Loved it. Ran around in the yard yelling Shazam when I wasn't being when I wasn't being bionic. That's what we would do. Yeah, Shazam and Super Friends were my two top TV shows and probably formulated my love and passion till this day.
Yeah, I mean, I said it was such a great thing to be able to watch Saturday morning cartoons and then end the day with live action Shazam. Because I remember in my market, it would air at noon. And that was kind of the transition to like at 1 o'clock, then like sports would come on. You know, right. And then I'm like, oh, I got to go outside or I got to, well, ideally go outside. More likely, I just change another channel and put on the Abbott and Costello movies they were showing on another channel. But you know, it was always that Jason of Star Command or ISIS or Shazam, where it was that transition of, oh, we're not watching cartoons anymore, but it's still stuff for me. And I love the Shazam show. Now, I haven't like kept up with it. I don't know why I haven't seen like an episode in a long time. But I absolutely loved it. And part of the reason this Treasury specifically, it's kind of amazing that we're almost 70 episodes into this show and we haven't gotten to it yet, was this Treasury, this one, was so special to me because mostly due to the photo cover of Jackson Bostwick as Captain Marvel. Because comics really didn't do photo covers. They did once in a blue moon when the company was really feeling expansive. But that cost more money. And that feeling I had as a kid that the Treasuries were special. They weren't just comics. They were like, you know, they were more. I mean, obviously they were more in size and more in price point, but they just were more impressive, more permanent.
Gold Key did photo covers in the 60s and 70s. And then for Treasuries, I think it's this one and the Superman 2 one. And that's all I could think of for having photo covers.
Yeah, that's pretty much. Yeah, I mean this one really. I remember reading this one at the time. I've told this story before about when my dad back when my mom was working on Saturdays and my dad occasionally had to go into the office on a Saturday to get caught up. He would take me with him, and he would plop me down at his secretary's desk. And the best way to keep me quiet was just buy me some comics. And we would go to like a Woolworths or some sort of department store, and he would buy me like 4 or 5 Treasuries. So for him, it was a $4 or $5 expenditure, which, you know, wasn't nothing back then, but it wasn't that much money. But it kept me quiet for like 5 hours. You can't, you know, I'm guessing when you're a parent, $5 to keep your kids quiet for a whole afternoon is that's a good return on investment. So I remember sitting at his secretary's desk reading this one specifically. Again, because the cover with Jackson Bostwick and he looks great. You know, I mean, of course, these images will be on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And it talks about the 4 king size stories, the 3D Rama cutout, exclusive scenes from the TV show, a pinup. I mean, this thing has so many special features. But man, I just took the. And it was funny, like when you see the ad in various DC comics, of course, they can't run a photo. So they have like a line drawing version of it. Which in some ways is kind of underselling it because right. If you think that you're like, oh, it's just a line drawing. But when you see it on a rack, you're like, oh my God, that looks so cool. And I love that he's popping out of the frame as well. It's just an absolutely beautiful cover.
Yeah. My parents would keep me quiet on the long drives between Air Force locations with bags and bags of comics. My sisters would get crossword puzzles and all that kind of crap. they would give me comics, and my mom was asleep once, and I'm looking at this issue of The Brave and the Bold, and I asked my father, Dad, what does bold mean? And my father said, bold means brave. And And I'm sitting there, a kid, I don't question my father. I'm like, the editors named it The Brave and the Brave?
The Brave and the Bold and the Bold? Is that the name of this series? Yeah. Yeah. I think Shag and I came to that conclusion, I don't know, like some episode, like not that long ago, where I was like, that's the same thing. You're saying The Brave and the Brave. Yeah. It's, I've been living with this comic for 50 years, and it never occurred to me before now. So, so this book, on the inside cover, there is the table of contents. There's a nice little drawing of Billy Batson and Shazam, which is lifted from another cover to the treasure, another Shazam treasury. Shazam got of course, he's called Shazam here because that was the name of the TV show. And due to the lawsuits, they couldn't call him Captain Marvel. Could they call him Captain Marvel on the cover? No, they couldn't. It even says Jesse Bostwick, star of CBS's TV Shazam. But I mean, Shazam got a lot of love at the treasuries. I mean, he got like four treasuries to himself within the first couple of years of limited collector's edition, which really, you know, underscored how much DC was pushing this character, that they had bought him from Fawcett and they were doing a big thing with him. And now he was a TV star. So, you know, along with Superman and Batman and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, he was like, you know, DC's big treasury star.
Yeah, picking this one up, I think this may have been my first Shazam treasury, because you go from that photo cover to the inside comic content, and the difference is kind of jarring.
Pretty stark.
Not that that put me off at all, but it's quite different from the photorealism and Jackson Boswick looking so darn serious and good in that outfit, and then CC Beck artwork.
Yeah, you're like, wait, huh? So, yeah. All right, well, that's a good segue. Let's get right to it. The first story is called Captain Marvel and the Robot Hunt. So, Chuck, take it away.
All right. The splash panel opens with Captain Marvel adding a word to his catchphrase as he swoops down exclaiming, "Holy jumping moly." The scene he is witnessing is a robot rhinoceros charging Mr. Morris, Billy Batson's boss at Station Wiz. The story opens in the woods as Billy and Mr. Morris are hunting and come upon a deer. But Mr. Morris can't bring himself to shoot. He finally drops the pretense and admits to Billy that he's too tender-hearted to kill an animal. The next day, Billy and Mr. Morris are discussing this at Station Wiz, when in walks Timmy Tinkle. Timmy Tinkle is a robot and a paid employee at the radio station, and he's being followed by a robot dog. Mr. Morris gets an idea, and next we are meeting the creator of the robot dog, Doc Quartz. Quartz is a one-panel described as an old pharmacist and spare-time scientist who works out of a backroom laboratory. That's really all we need. Doc Quartz and Mr. Morris have hatched a plan to build a robot animals for Mr. Morris to hunt, thereby allowing him to hunt while sidestepping his tender-hearted attitude towards killing animals. The first shot is barely fired when the radio controls blows up. The robot rhino horns Doc Quartz in the pants, and Billy yells his magic word. This is where you think the robot crushing action is going to begin, and you would be incorrect. Just as Captain Marvel is about to go into action, Timmy Tinkle reminds Marvel that the animals are friendly, just like the robot dog, and it would be wrong to destroy them just because it's a convenient way to keep them out of trouble. But nevertheless, the robots go on a rampage of trickery and mischievousness, forcing Captain Marvel to intervene for public safety. Unable to destroy the robots or even let them roam free, Marvel uses the wisdom of Solomon to build a robot zoo. This makes everyone happy as Timmy Tinkle can visit his robot friends, they'll stay out of trouble, and Mr. Morris can continue to shoot them, but this time use a camera instead of a gun.
Wow. Okay. what did you think of this story?
Well, they introduced Timmy Tinkle just as if he's always been there and it's normal to have a robot walking around in your office. And I just went with it. I mean, I remember as a kid, it's like, okay, it's just stuff I don't know. It's nothing like the TV show, but let's go ahead. Timmy Tinkle, okay, I'm on board. And I remember as a kid, I loved the resolution, and I thought it made so much sense. Why do we have to shoot animals with guns when we can just use cameras?
I've been talking about this over on the For All Mankind show, the Super Friends podcast they do, where I'd be kind of critical of the stories that I think Denny O'Neill was writing, or, you know, Sergius O'Shaughnessy, because they're so fantastical, where just stuff just happens because it can. And right. I'm always like, you know, I kind of been kind of knocking them a little, at least compared to the E. Nelson Bridwell stories, which, while also crazy, have some sort of internal consistency to them, I guess. And yet here, the crazy world of the Marvel family doesn't bother me in the least. You know what I mean? Like, there are robot animals. There's a robot, and it's yeah. and there's a talking tiger. It's all good. It's all the same. Like, there's something about that this universe is so specifically batshit nuts that you just got to go along with it. And it probably has to be part of the work of CC Beck, is that it just has that, you know, it's realistic, and that it's the anatomy is, yes, it's cartoony, but it's somewhat based on real figures. But yet it just, I don't know, it kind of, I found this story to be very charming. Part of it was, like you were talking about the hunting, was yeah. that, yeah, I don't, you know, I'm a big animal rights person, and I don't like the idea of, just the idea of, let's not be cruel if we don't, why are we being cruel? Let's not do that. And I think that's a nice lesson to impart from Captain Marvel. But yeah, this is just a really charming story, and you just have to go with the craziness of it. Like, all right, there's a zoo full of robot animals now. All right, that's a thing.
Yeah, and there two things strike me. Well, Otto Binder was the writer for a lot of the Captain Marvel stories, and he helped guide it. But I love, both with Superman and Captain Marvel, they weren't fighting villains that were on their power level. And that didn't happen till the 70s. They were finding ways to get... The writers found ways to stump Captain Marvel from solving every situation with his fists, and giving us a story where both Captain Marvel and Superman had to figure their way out of this without just punching their way out. Mm-hmm. And it was always frustrating to me as a kid when other kids would say, I don't like Superman, he's too powerful, he's unrelatable. There's no story there. Or even when Denny O'Neill said it in multiple interviews, he blew out the sun. So what else is there left to challenge Superman? Well, that's your job to tell us.
Yeah. Yeah. Come up with some problem that pure muscle doesn't solve. There you yeah. go. And yeah, Cap, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of these in these stories of where there's a dilemma that you would think with Captain Marvel's powers he could get out of, but no, he needs to kind of think his way out of it, or, you know, reason his way out of it. And yeah, so it's really, like I said, it's really quite charming. I love the scuffed up Captain Marvel at the last page where he's got all the stuff, you know, it just, and he always has that permanent squint, you know, he's always kind of looking at it like that. Yeah, it's really sweet. It is, as you say, quite a sea change from the cover. Because, you know, yeah. you've got this photorealistic cover. And, of course, on the TV show, Captain Marvel couldn't do any of this stuff because they couldn't afford robot animals on that show. He had to, you know, oh, look, somebody's trapped in a well. All right, let's you know, Shazam, you know, let's do that. But, yeah, it's really charming. It's really cute. I mean, it's worth, you know, remembering Captain Marvel was, at one point, the biggest selling comic book out there, more than Superman. I mean, that's part of the reason he probably got in DC's crosshairs.
Right.
That, you know, they didn't bother going after some of the lesser lights. But when they saw Captain Marvel was headlining in the 50s, in the 40s, like six titles at one point? I mean, it was amazing. Yeah, it's a really charming story, and kind of a great way to kind of dip your toe into these the world of Captain Marvel as the first story in the book. So after that is a Shazam puzzle page. Which features members of the Marvel family, you know, giving little riddles that you have to answer. And when they do this in other books, I've taken time to notice that, like, clearly these were puzzle pages cribbed from like some crossword magazine that they just drew Batman's head in at the end to make it look like, you know, it's meant to be content. But this is clearly originally Shazam related content, because Mary Marvel is inside one of the panels and Captain Marvel Jr. is in one of the panels, and there's another one with Shazam. So this is clearly probably from a old Shazam comic that they just reprinted. It's not something that they cribbed from something else.
Love it.
Yeah. So the next story is kind of the epic one of the book. It's called Captain Marvel and the plot, Captain Marvel Battles, the plot against the universe. It's from Captain Marvel Adventures number 100. It's by Otto Binder and C.C. Beck. Now, I'm going to do a very short synopsis of this story because this thing goes on and on and on and on and on. And writing the synopsis of it just got me exhausted. I was just like, okay, we could cut to the chase of this. So basically, Dr. Savannah travels back in time to the moment of the origin of Captain Marvel. He becomes a phantom, takes over the Rock of Eternity, endangers the wizard Shazam himself, and through him, Captain Marvel. Savannah then forces Captain Marvel into helping him creating an army of Savannah duplicates. Captain Marvel makes a duplicate of himself and foils Savannah's evil plans. So, okay, what did you think of this sort of epic tale?
Love, 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 love this one. I remember reading this and rereading this and, I don't really understand what happened. Maybe I read it again and try to figure this out. But yeah, this was the bee's knees back when I was a kid.
What do you think of Savannah as a villain? As you think, you know, like, is he, I don't know, is he too Luthor-y? Is he too, he's so weird looking that yeah. It always just feels a little like, can't Captain Marvel just do something about this guy? I mean, come on.
He's much different from Luthor in these early appearances. He's way over the top. They do a good job of making him disgusting. You never feel sorry for Savannah. Not only does he look repulsive, but he has that creepy laugh that they keep using. Yeah. And even all his robots use that creepy laugh. And they even have one shot in this story where a bunch of robots are surrounding Captain Marvel and giving him the laugh and teasing him and all that. And you're like, Savannah's the bully. Captain Marvel's more powerful, he's stronger and faster, and he's more handsome, but Savannah is the one you just really want to punch in the face.
There's something kind of, again, so low-key, old school, you know, as you said, bully, it's a great word for it, about Savannah. When it's the splash page for chapter 3, The Evil Element, and you've got all the Savannah duplicates, and, you know, Savannah wants to kind of kill Captain Marvel, but what are the evil duplicates doing? One of them is pinching his nose. Another one is shooting him with like an ink gun on his emblem. Another one is literally kicking him in the rear. And then another one has a can of itching powder. So, you know, like they're just a bunch of jerks, really. It's just really, really, they did their best in the movie, I think, to kind of make Savannah, you know, like, okay, he can't be this sort of goofy. And I always did find it a little creepy, and they don't appear in the story, that Savannah has two sets of children, and one set looks like him, and the other set kind of look like the Aryan master race sort of thing. Like, that's, you know, it's always like a weird, like, all right, what's going on here? And this story, I find, like, it's paced a little bit like the movie serial, I think. And then, you know, it's so long, and then I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's 30 pages, is that it kind of just has these ups and downs, ups and downs, ups and downs, and each one has got kind of like this cliffhanger, even though you're just supposed to go right to the next page, but it's paced like that. It just has that kind of, you know, beat up kind of thing to it. And, you know, that's, I have to think that, you know, the Captain Marvel movie serial, now that was in 1941, that was long before, they printed this comic, but you know, that was a big hit, and I have to feel that it must have had some sort of influence on maybe the writing of these stories. To me, it just has that kind of pace to it.
Yeah, a lot of the 40s comics I read are not one giant story. Even if it's like Batman, he'll have four different stories in there. And I remember the Golden Age Flash had a couple stories like this, but where you find one story throughout the whole comic, even though it's split into four different chapters, that's kind of rare back then.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was rare for Captain Marvel.
Yeah, they had to really, when you think about like how many stories, you know, the average issue of a superhero comic was 52 pages. And like you said, they had like four stories. Like they had to come up with four separate premises for Batman every month. For years on end, like that's really hard. You know, it's a little easier to come up with one premise and then just stretch it out, but as opposed to four premises, like, oh my God. So yeah, this is sort of the centerpiece of the book, is this sort of epic story. And again, it's taking on Savannah, and it, you know, we get a recap of the origin, I have always loved the design of the seven deadly sins, those statues. Those are just so beautifully weird looking with their sort of distended faces and stuff like that. You know, and again, it's a fun idea that Savannah can go back in time and, yes, you know, interrupt the origin. He's kind of doing a Thanos thing where he's going back and, you know, kind of stopping before all this happens. Now, in the middle of the book itself is a 2-page pinup, which is a vertical pinup. The pinup is so large they had to print it vertically, of our three main heroes, Captain Marvel, Captain Marvel Jr., and Mary Marvel. I believe it's drawn by Bob Oxner, I think. Especially Mary Marvel, that has kind of an Oxner face to me. What did you think of that pinup?
Yeah, the centerfold was by Bob Oxner. At least it's credited that on comics.org. Okay. At first glance, I loved it, but an initial look, not so much. The figures seem a little wonky to me, and it's sparse. But yeah, opening up to the middle and in that initial impact, you're like, oh, thank God.
It's huge. I mean, again, taking up two treasury pages, it's a huge, huge pinup. Right. And then the end of this story wraps up on page 42 of the book. Now, I've not read the original comic. I'm only reading the story from the treasury. This ending must be something else, because at the end of this story, you've got Captain Marvel holding the very comic that this story appeared in. And he says, folks, the story you just read first appeared in Captain Marvel Avengers number 100 back in 1949. We promise to do our best to bring you the most thrilling stories possible in every issue of Shazam, as well as our TV show. Right? Great, yeah. Sir and Mr. Tony. And Shazam's like, correct, my son. And Mr. Talkie Tony's like, you said it, Captain Marvel. And, you know, and then you said there's an inset of Billy Batson. Those are my sentiments too, folks. Be seeing you. And then there's a little panel with Savannah. So I don't know what that final panel was, but obviously they went and redrew it to kind of tie it into the TV show. So again, you know, they weren't missing a trick here. We're reminding you, hey, it's a Shazam TV show you want to watch, kids.
Yeah, I'm betting it was a 1/3 page ad and a Billy Batson wrap up.
Probably. Yeah, I don't know the original comic. So after the story, there's another Shazam puzzle page. Now, when you were a kid, did you draw in your treasuries to like solve these puzzles and stuff, or did you not mar your comics like that?
I believe that I did. In pencil, like that would make a difference. And then I know that for the drawing lessons that we get after that, I did take that and try that out. And I drew superheroes for a long time, and even thought I was going to be an artist. And then one day in 10th grade, just kind of woke up and said, oh, I don't have any talent.
There were a lot of people who come to that realization much later than that, Chuck. So good on you. The next bunch of bonus features is Shazam Presents How to Draw Cap's Friends and Foes. And it is a 2-page feature showing you how to draw Savannah and Mr. Talkie Tawny and Mr. Mind. And then there's even a self-portrait of presumably Kurt Schaffenberger, who draws the sequence, complaining about that he is creating instant competition for himself. And there's even a little Mr. Mind setting a bomb off under his drawing table. I love that Kurt Schaffenberger, I guess, looked like Clark Kent with a mustache. It's a great... Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, he even got his signature right there. It says KS down at the bottom. I always love these features. And I have to think these were somewhat inspirational to me, is why I wanted to draw comic books and I went to art school and stuff like that, because this isn't really the way you draw these things exactly, but you know, just showing you the basic building blocks of it, it does demystify it a little bit. And I always thought that I loved it when DC would do these. I always thought these were very, very charming.
Did you go to art school? I hadn't heard.
Very funny. So I really walked into that one. So the next story is The Marvel Family Curse. It is from Marvel Family number 17. It is by Bill Wulfhook and Kurt Schaffenberger. While searching through old records, Freddie Freeman finds the diary of Joseph Batson, where he recounts how he captured the Salem witch. Before accidentally setting herself on fire, the witch says the seventh generation of Batsons will perish in flames. Freddie thinks of how this is 1947, and Billy and Mary are the seventh generation of Batsons. Later, Captain and Mary Marvel save people from a fire. They investigate and discover the owner of the building is involved, who burns down buildings for insurance. Billy and Mary learn that this man is a descendant of the witch. After they revert to being Billy and Mary, they are captured by the man, but Captain Marvel Jr. saves them. The arsonist threatens them with a thermite flask, but he falls down steps and it explodes, killing him in flames. Cap comments that the descendant of the Salem witch nearly made the old curse come true. So, a bit of a tonal change, I'd say, with this story. Would you agree with that, Chuck?
I would. I know that in the 50s, the Marvel family stories were starting to incorporate horror more. I mean, horror on the Fawcett level, not on the EC Comics level. But yeah, this seems much more in that vein. And that picture of that witch being on fire, oh man, that stuck with me.
It's about as grim as it's going to get for a Captain Marvel comic. And the scene where the arsonist trips down the stairs. Now he dies off panel, but we see this flame, and then we see Captain Marvel say, "The thermite flask exploded, and when he fell on it, what a horrible way to die!" Like, wow. Again, like you said, did the EC writer step in to write this one? Like, geez, guys.
So this story also has one of the elements that I love about Captain Marvel, and it's the only time in this treasury that it picks up, and that's the jeopardy. I am gagged. I can't say my magic word.
Right, right.
About to die. And then someone comes along and removes the gag just in time. I love kind of that moment.
They were constantly getting kidnapped and having gags put on them. That was constantly a thing going on. Like I said, it's credited to Kurt Schaffenberger, and so this is kind of early in his style, and you can sort of see the development of it. I love Mary Marvel in her plaid skirt and her little platform shoes, very Catholic schoolgirl kind of thing going on there. And you know, and I also like when Captain Marvel punches guys, it's got a slight extra level of grit to it than maybe like CC Beck. CC Beck guys, they look a little, even Captain Marvel's hitting people, looks a little gentle. But like in near the second to last page where Captain Marvel breaks into the window, and he says, "I wouldn't pay if I were you," and he punches three crooks simultaneously, and he's kind of gritting his teeth, and it just has just a slightly extra level of grit to it that you would expect from a Captain Marvel story.
Right, right. It is, like you said, totally different from the first two.
Yeah, it really is. And it also features the final page, the bottom third. There's a little blurb for comics cards, which appeared in Marvel Family number 17, in which the Marvel Family curse was first published. And these little inset trading cards shot of Mary Marvel, one of her flying, and one with her riding a giant butterfly. And the lines are dotted, which is to indicate, children, you were supposed to cut them out. And did you do that?
No.
Okay. No. Yeah, neither did I. But yeah, there's probably, you know, at least a couple copies of these books out there that are marred. Kids were like, "Oh, sure, I'll do that. Why not?" Like, yeah, well, you're ruining your collectible here. So, so we got the final story, which is called Captain Marvel Battles the World. So, Chuck, take it away.
All right, this story is told, believe it or not, from the perspective of a pissed-off planet Earth who has had enough of humans. Earth is annoyed by all the little pinpricks of humans digging into its skin in order to drill for oil. One pinprick too much, and Earth decides it's going to get rid of everyone. So how's the Earth going to do that? It's going to withdraw the clouds and bake us with direct sun, smash icebergs together so that the noise will knock over our buildings, and crack South America loose, swinging it around and crash into North America, which is all crazy. But each time, Captain Marvel flies in to save the day, never knowing that he's battling an upset Earth. He stops the heat wave with a meteor composed of billions of tons of solid ice that melts in Earth's atmosphere and creates cloud cover. He stops the noisily clashing icebergs with huge bundles of felt that he stuffs between them. And he finally stops the unmoored bumper continent by using hot lava as glue and replacing South America back where it belongs. But the Earth isn't done yet, and it feels embarrassed and humiliated by Captain Marvel's efforts, so it prepares to let loose and wipe out humans with a worldwide burst of earthquakes, floods, hurricanes, eruptions, and falling mountains. But the moon interrupts, pointing out to Earth a giant comet, the biggest they've ever seen, heading straight towards the Earth. And this panics our planet, who is sure to be smashed to bits. But in the nick of time, Captain Marvel flies up to meet the comet with a boulder of plutonium, which he explains is the stuff they use in atomic bombs. He throws the plutonium into the comet, setting off a chain reaction that atomizes the threat, and Earth is saved. Earth begins to relax after Captain Marvel's planet-saving move, and the moon even points out how lucky Earth is to have all those cute little humans living on it when absolutely no one lives on the moon. And then, weirdly enough, Billy Batson wraps up the whole story as if he knew what the Earth was thinking.
prescient. You gotta give him credit. This is a story for our time. Again, this is like the perfect combination of goofy as all get out, because you've literally got an Earth with a face on it talking, and yet it's got all these environmental concerns, which are fairly sophisticated to put into a children's comic from like the 1940s. You know, it's pretty amazing. It's so goofy. What did you think of it?
Well, I remember as a kid, I did not like this one. I found it the most boring and the most confusing. But as an adult, I immediately think, oh, this is going to be an ecology message. But I don't know that it counts, because in the end, the Earth is like, okay, keep on drilling.
Yeah.
I'm fine with it. Okay, Captain Marvel has taught me that your drilling for fossil fuels is okay.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit disappointed by that, especially in the 70s when, you know, that kind of stuff was just starting to get talked about seriously. And here we're publishing a comic from the 50s that kind of makes it a child's tale. I did like the way Captain Marvel handled everything very seriously. Mm-hmm.
It's sort of funny for a story. Captain Marvel, like if you just look at the pages, like Captain Marvel's not in it a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of the pages are just the ecological disaster stuff. You know, I mean, he's flying around a little bit, but I mean, there's large sections where you just see the Earth just sort of is rumbling and stuff like that. And yeah, you got to wonder who was the credited writer on this? I forget. Is it Otto Binder?
Otto Binder and C.C. Beck is the artist.
Okay. You got to wonder, like, Otto Binder was, like, writing this story, and maybe he wanted to go for, like, a grimmer ending, and then the editor was like, all right, Otto, like, you know, we can't really do a thing where we're saying anything bad about the oil industry at this point, so let's just, okay, all right, Mother Earth's okay with it. And then, of course, Earth also doesn't like the fact that it's called Mother Earth. that name makes me boil. Ah, calm down, Brother Earth. You're getting crotchety in your old age. Forget about it. Be glad that mighty Captain Marvel's around to protect and mother you. Just like, what is this? Where, you know, like, this is just such a crazy world. And it's sort of funny. There was the Shazam cartoon show in the 70s. I assume you watched that as well?
Oh, yes.
Now, from what I remember of that show, it was very 70s, and it didn't really even approach like this level of weirdness. Like, it was really just, again, kind of almost like an animated version of the TV show with some more fanciful elements, but it was sort of funny. Like, you really could have done an amazing cartoon with this crazy world, and they didn't really do that, I guess, because again, they wanted to maybe keep it a little more grounded, I guess. But like, I would have loved to have seen an episode where the Earth has a face on it and is talking.
Right. That cartoon debuted in the same season that Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends did.
Did it really? But, oh, I thought it was earlier than that. Okay.
That cartoon was definitely aimed at smaller kids with a humor element to it and much more simplistic stories. But you're right. These old stories in the comics seem to be much weirder and therefore more appealing. And while still appealing towards kids, both properties appeal towards kids, but you've got the weird and the horror and the savannah and everything else in the comics that that cartoon was missing. Mm.
This treasure really does kind of get at the sort of breadth of kind of stories that you could tell with this character or with these characters. Because, I mean, you look at these four stories, and yeah, they're all goofy in one way or another, but they are very all kind of different from each other. You know, you've got an ecological concern, and you've got a animal kind of cruelty story, and then you've got the Savannah one, which is just kind of like a jam-packed action adventure, and then you've got the Captain Marvel Jr. one. And, I mean, that, of course, was probably, you have to do that when you're cranking out 1,000 Captain Marvel stories a year. you know, you're going to have some variations. But it's interesting to show that, you know, they could put across a lot of different kinds of stories featuring this character. And then, of course, you could see why DC had such an uphill climb trying to recapture that flavor in the 1970s.
Right.
In the cynical 1970s, you know, Watergate era 1970s, trying to bring this back and not make it just seem so kind of ridiculous. That's an uphill climb. And that's the book only lasted, what, about 30-something issues? They made such a big splash about it, but it didn't last terribly long.
Yeah. So I never knew about the regular monthly. The only Shazam comics I had were these Treasuries. Mm. And I thought I was a huge comic collector, but I was no Richie Rich. The first time I knew of a bigger world, we were at Ocean City, Maryland, and I walked to this bookstore hoping to find comics, and it was the first time ever that I found a back issue bin. I'd never seen that anywhere.
A big moment in any young boy's life.
Yeah, yes. It was game-changing. And I only bought two comics that day. One was an X-Men where Storm was on the cover fighting Dr. Doom. And I'd never heard of that. Let me grab that. And then I found Shazam and was just blown away that there had been a monthly comic that I never knew about. And on the cover was Captain Marvel and Captain Marvel Jr. fighting Captain Nazi. And I get that back to our rental and find that it's got Don Newton artwork in it.
Whoa.
It was, yeah. I was like, this isn't a Captain Marvel comic for older kids. I am in.
Yeah. Don Newton, man. Oh, it's a darn shame that they did the Captain Marvel Treasuries. They did four of them in pretty short succession and then not again. That, you know, after the TV show went off the air, they didn't do it again. I mean, he would come back for the Superman versus Shazam Treasury, the all original Treasury. But this was, you know, they did them very early on and then they didn't do them again. And it would have been real. I mean, Don Newton artwork in Treasury size would have been absolutely magnificent. So,
well,
yeah.
They have this in this last story I did want to mention. They do have this one shot of Captain Marvel as he's hurtling down towards the earth and, it's over half the page, a shot of him.
Yep.
And he's shaded a bit from below, and it's probably the best shot of him in that whole Treasury.
Yep. Yeah, again, really hard to draw a figure like that. I've had to do it myself really, really hard, you know, to make that look right. But, as I said, it's a fun story. And, again, you know, it's not, despite the slightly cop-out ending, it's making kids think a little, and there's nothing wrong with that. So, yeah, it's a really fun piece to end the book on. So on the inside cover is the Shazam on Television feature, which features photos of our actors, Michael Gray and Les Tremaine and Jackson Bostwick, in various shots from the TV show. And, you know, I'm, again, as a kid, I ate this stuff up because, you know, you didn't really see this kind of, I mean, like when they would do the stuff for Batman or the Superman TV shows, it was cool because I didn't really have access to like famous monsters. I didn't see it a lot on my newsstand, so you didn't see just a lot of this stuff outside in sort of magazine form. So I always loved this stuff, and I got to say, I really want that Shazam T-shirt that Michael Gray has got, yeah. That white shirt with the Shazam logo. I don't know if that exists or you have to make it yourself, but I would love to just have that shirt. That's so beautiful.
Rob, to hell with that. I want the Winnebago.
Well, the Winnebago with the giant lightning bolt in the front would be really amazing as well. Yeah, it's really.
My wife and I have a deal. She's all about getting some kind of camper at some point, and I'm only if I can put Shazam symbol.
That seems like a reasonable trade-off. You're not asking for that much.
Yeah.
You're not asking to drive around and have adventures with some weird old man. I mean, you're just.
I did definitely ask if she and I could travel around and have adventures.
Okay. All right. Well, you'll have to get back to us if you guys ever do that. So there's the little feature there. And then on the back cover is a tabletop diorama, which features a line art version of Jackson Bostwick as Shazam. I can't quite recognize the art style. Who drew that? It's probably some DC, you know, some Woodchuck staffer. Through that, did you ever cut these out, the dioramas?
Only once, and that was on the Ace Kilroy Treasury edition.
Well, you've ruined the value of that now. I never did this myself, not because I was worried about the value of these comics, it's just because I was lazy, you know. It's just like I don't know how to sit there and cut all these out, and this is just too much work for me. So, but yeah, so mine remains intact. So overall, it's a really solid Treasury. It's probably my favorite of the Shazams just because it makes such an explicit tie-in to the TV show. Again, that photo cover is just the best thing ever. I mean, that's a cut, you know, that costume in an era where the actors didn't get padding. Yeah. It looks pretty good. Like it holds up pretty well. It doesn't look ridiculous. I mean, Jackson Bostwick was a muscular guy. He wasn't ripped the way we demand actors are nowadays, like the Henry Cavill, you know, where you look just absolutely ridiculous. But I mean, I don't know. I look at this photo and I just say, you know, this doesn't look crazy to me.
It's very believable. If I was hurt in a ravine with a rattlesnake approaching me quickly and I saw this dude approaching, I'd be, thank God.
That's absolutely. Maybe you'll have to try to like fake it as a kid or something just to see if Shazam shows up to help you or whatever. So, but overall, so Chuck, what do you feel about this trade? You feel like it's a good cross section of the character? I mean, do you think if you were a kid and you were learning about this character, would you want to read more if you read these stories?
Oh, definitely. I had two of the Shazam treasuries. I loved them both. Read all about Mary Marvel. And of course, their appearances in the Christmas treasuries I had. But all of these stories are from the Fawcett issues. None of them were from the DC issues, which I never saw until
very,
later.
Very telling.
Yes. And those are very different.
Yeah.
So as an adult, I'm always, you know, try out both. I love the Fawcett stories. The old Captain Marvel Fawcett issues are excellent. So I'd always put my weight behind that.
Absolutely. Well, Chuck, thank you for you reached out to me and asked that you wanted to do this one. And again, it was kind of amazing that we had never gotten to it yet because, again, it's so beloved to me. It's one of the ones that the copy... I don't know anymore. I mean, but I think the copy that I have here that I'm holding, I think might be the one that I had as a kid because I held on to my treasuries. And so this might be the same. I don't ever recall buying this one a second time. So this might be the same one that I sat and read when I was, you know, 7 years old or whatever. So it's held up. The staples are still intact. You know, it's a good value of my dad's, you know, inflation ravaged dollar back in 1976 or whatever. So, again, thank you so much for doing this and talking Captain Marvel with me.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I still have the treasury that I had as a kid, but I've had to recollect the Mego doll, the Viewmaster reel, and the cereal bowl that I had with Shazam on it as a kid.
There was a cereal bowl with Shazam on it?
Oh, yes, it's wonderful.
Wow.
I had the Shazam one. My sister had the Wonder Woman one, but she didn't really care.
You were a regular reader of my Aquaman Shrine blog, so you probably remember my bitter posts that I would put up occasionally talking about how Aquaman got replaced on a lot of DC merchandise in the 70s because Shazam was a TV star and Aquaman wasn't. I can't blame DC for that, but nevertheless, as an Aquaman fan... It would bother the hell out of me to see group shots, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Shazam. I'm like, oh, now come on, you know? And so there's a lot of merchandise out there with Shazam on it that couldn't have been Aquaman. Like, there was like a watch. I remember there was a kid's watch. I didn't know there was a cereal bowl. There was a plush doll. So there were the sticker books on the DC calendar that Chris Franco talked about, and then his Neil Adams article on 13th Dimension. That Aquaman's not on it, but Shazam is. So, you know, I have always loved this character. I've always loved Captain Marvel, always loved Shazam. But I did have a bit of a grudge because it was just like, they just were like, he was constantly pushing Aquaman off the stage, you know.
And what do you do in 1977 when you've got him as a Mego doll and he doesn't fit with the others because he's not in the Justice League, he's not in the Super Friends?
Right. He really should have been in the Super Friends. I never understood why he was not in the Super Friends.
Yeah.
You know, he had a lot of kid, you know, kid marquee value. Tonally, he fits in exactly right. So that's weird. You know, that's what's strange to me. Of course, he appears in the live action special.
Maybe Filmation just had the rights.
You know what? Maybe so. Maybe that's what it was. That might have been exactly what it was. Because, of course, like I said, he He appeared in those weird roasts that they did in the 70s. So, otherwise, as I said, it's a really solid trilogy, one of the great books, and one of the reasons why I love this format so much. So Chuck, before you go, why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Well, I have an Instagram account where I post pictures of my toy collection and sometimes panels for my comic reading. You can check that out at AquaDCD. And while I don't have a podcast of my own, I occasionally appear on Checkered Past. It's a read-through show where my good friends Dr. Bob and Dr. Husband are making their way through the go-go checkered era of DC Comics in the 60s. And it's a hoot because Dr. Bob is a comics expert and Dr. Husband has no childhood nostalgia for comics at all. But he brings the muggle. And Rob, I got to tell you, there was one instance where he showed open disgust for the concept of Earth 2, which made me drive my car off the road. And one time while reading an Aquaman comic, and I was guesting on the show where they did this, Dr. Husband badmouthed the Nick Carty artwork.
Oh, no. No. Well, what was the problem with it?
They've been doing this so long that Dr. Husband has actually turned things around, changed his opinion, and now seems to have a love of the material.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, because no, that's not a thing. Not liking Nick Carty is not a thing. So, again, Chuck, it was great to finally get a chance to talk to you again. We've been interacting online for better part of more than a decade at this point. So it was great to finally have you on one of my shows. So, of course, everybody, I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to play some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Hey, Mike, have you heard about my new podcast?
Oh, what's that?
Oh, it's where you talk to people on your computer and then put it out on the internet.
Yes, I know what a podcast is, Paul, but what's the show you're doing?
Yeah, I'm going to talk to people on my computer and then put it out on the internet.
And what's this called?
Since it's a chat show and I really want to talk to interesting people about interesting things, I thought I'd call it something that was, self-explanatory, like Dial F for Flanger.
Right. Dial F for Flanger. Cool. I look forward to my guest spot. When are you going to have me on?
I'll get back.
Wow. Well, if you'd like to hear Paul chatting away on this Dial F for Flanger show, you can find it on the Waiting for Doom Network.
Stellar Studios presents An Into the Weird and A World on Fire production.
Starring, in alphabetical order,
Brainwave Jr.,
Fury,
Jade,
Northwind,
Nuclon,
Obsidian,
The Silver Scarab,
The Star Spangled Kid.
These are the members of Infinity Inc., the protégés and children of the legendary Justice Society.
Created by Roy Thomas, Jerry Ordway, and Mike Macklin, their 1980s adventures are chronicled at last by Herman Lowe and Billy Dee, two podcasters with way too much time on their hands, but dedicated to analyzing, glorifying, and sometimes vilifying the stories from the team's first series.
So hop in your Star Rocket Racer, switch on the radio, and let's rediscover the Earth 2 we'd all like to go back to. Star Rocket Radio, an Infinity Inc. podcast. Soaring through the Podosphere since September 2021.
And it's time for our listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on Treasury Cast episode number 68, where we covered Tops with my very special guest, Michael T. Gilbert. First up is Matt Sorois, who says, "Fascinating. I'm one of those obsessive nerds that love comic book history. For decades, publishers ignored all these esoteric titles that had very brief shelf lives while reprinting early Batman, Superman, and the EC Comics library dozens upon dozens of times. This book looks great, even if not all the stories are all that interesting. Well, not everything in human history is interesting, but you can learn things from it anyway. That page featuring the sewer treasure hunting is so packed with detail, I could look at it until I went cross-eyed. I'm not sure why, but I feel as though the woman holding her head on what was the cover of the first issue was named Gloria. It was either something that was said or their voices in her head that calling Gloria. I also had no idea that exploding children were an issue facing our country back in the 40s. I also want to know if I can handle the pressure of being on a parole board. I'll be ordering this book to find out more." Yes, Matt, report back. Edo Boznar says, love that you covered this book and spoke to Mr. Gilbert himself. I only just heard of it recently, precisely because his new reprint book had just been published. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation and all the background information. I've always had a soft spot for these daring publisher projects that unfortunately never went anywhere. Like, say, the It Rhymes with Lust Pycno novel from the early 1950s, Gil Kane's early attempts at adult-oriented graphic novels, His Name is Savage and Blackmark, or the Fiction Illustrated series and several similar books produced by Byron Preece back in the 1970s. Tops fit right in that category, and I'll definitely be keeping an eye out for it, even if, yes, it's a bit pricey for me. By the way, it's good to know how to finally pronounce Biro's name, i.e. Biro. I was never sure if I was Biro, which is how I've heard it pronounced on another comics podcast several years ago. Again, great show, Rob, and hats off to Michael. Paul Kien from this very network says, you got me, Rob. I'm 15 minutes in, and I looked at the gallery post and just went and ordered the book. I'll be back after reading it. And great get to have Michael on the show. Thank you, Paul. Also from our network, Siskoid says, I can confirm that due to the kid gang craze started by Kirby, Daredevil had become a guest star in his own book, even more so than, say, Guardian was in the Newsboy Legion strips, and very early, too, more than 5 years before this particular story was adapted for Tops. It put me down for a nice Mr. Monster collection as well. It would be Tops. Martin Gray says, nope, I've never heard of this comic either, but within 15 minutes, I had also ordered it. That's what happens when a top guest meets great host. It's due tomorrow, and I'm excited. Later, Martin sent a picture of the Tops book having arrived, and I sent that photo over to Michael, who, of course, was very happy to see that we moved some books for him. Also from our network, Chris Franco says, great discussion. It goes without saying the art in these books is gorgeous. I wonder if the cover story in issue number one about our explosive children ever caught the eye of a certain Dr. Wortham. It doesn't surprise me that Mr. Gilbert managed to make the collected volume feel like an authentic 1940s comic. He pulled it off expertly in one of my favorite issues, Batman Legends of the Dark Knight number 94. There he interpreted the art styles of Bob Kane, Dick Sprang, and Neil Adams, and even made it look like the pages came from that era. I've never read that story. Chris, that sounds really cool. I got to check that out. Dr. Ann says, I'd like to consider myself an author, amateur comic book historian. I've never heard of this book before, not even a mention. Thanks for covering this book, especially with Mr. Gilbert. Such a great review and history lesson. Amazing. Yeah, totally. As I said in the show, I never heard of it either. It wasn't until Mark Evanier just made that random comment about Tops that, you know, made me go, what? What's Tops? Continuing on, Brett Young says, I'll be honest, before listening to the Tops podcast, I took a quick look at the gallery and thought, what the hell is this? Then I listened to your conversation with Michael T. Gilbert and found it riveting. What a great story behind this bizarre collection. Now I don't know what to do first. Get on the parole board or look for gold in the sewer. Well done, Rob. This is why Treasury Cast is my favorite. Thank you, Brett. Ward Hill Terry says, thank you, Michael T. Gilbert. Thank you for your great comics. Thank you for your preservation and restoration of Tops. Thank you for talking to our pal Rob on this podcast. Yes to all of that. And then the final comment is from Russell Rosenkild, who has more of a generalized comment about Treasury Comics in the series. He says, first of all, thank you for your podcast and your devotion to the Treasury Size comics. I have binge listened to every episode of Treasury Cast over the past 3 weeks and enjoyed each one immensely, even the episodes I had no interest in, Transformers, G.I. Joe. I have learned quite a bit about these oversized wonders, things I never knew, like the redrawing of Superman's face on the Super Friends Treasury cover, and that the cover of the Justice League Treasury is by Dick Giordano. I always believed the front and back to be by Neil Adams, so thank you for correcting me. I have two copies of the JLA Treasury, one where they properly colored Green Arrow on the cover, and another where his legs are colored yellow. The wealth of knowledge from you and your guests has been astounding, and a huge thank you to all of them. I especially love the episodes about the Hanna-Barbera treasuries. I found all three of them several years ago at One Stop Comics in Oak Park, Illinois, for the price of $3 each. Until I saw the treasuries laying on a table in the back of the store, I had no idea they even existed. Best $9 I ever spent. This is me cutting in here, Russell. Yeah, that's a hell of a deal. I'm glad you picked them up. Anyway, he continues. My treasury collection is nearly complete. The only DC that I do not own is the first one ever, the implied C-20, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I have a complete run of Marvel Treasury Edition, all the one-shots, like Captain America's Bicentennial, and the two Wizard of Oz issues, Annie and Star Wars, including some of the Whitman variants for titles like Close Encounters. Will you be doing a specific podcast regarding those offbeat Whitman issues of the Treasuries? Me jumping in again. Maybe. You never know. Back to Russell. In the early 1980s, when I left home for college, my stepmother sold my comic book collection to a local dealer for a mere $100. Oh, and I've spent the intervening years recouping my lost collection. In my quest, I found a four-issue series of Treasury comics published by the Racine Press Western called Golden Picture Storybooks. The first two issues were devoted to Hanna-Barbera characters, Huckleberry Hound and Yogi Bear, respectively. And the third and fourth are Disney, Babes in Toyland, and Disney Ducks. Any chance you have heard or seen of these unique books? And will you do a podcast about them if you have? All four issues list in Overstreet as scarce. Me cutting in once again. Yes, Russell, I actually have all four of those books. As I mentioned with Chuck about when he talked about picking up treasuries in the 90s, I discovered them, I think, just on eBay. Maybe in Overstreet? I don't know. But I don't know how. Anyway, I came across them, and I quickly picked them up. So, yeah, I have all four of them. Whether we'll ever get to them, I don't know. I generally, as I said, I kind of like let the guests pick what books they want to talk about, and no one's ever suggested them. But you know, it's possible. Anyway, back to Russell's comment. I remember purchasing my first Treasury Justice League from the newsstand, but cannot remember if it was the Crawford Structured Store or one of the five local 7-Elevens in the area. Five. My brother and I would ride our bikes to each place and find the new comics that came out that week. Since there were no comic stores back then, it was hit and miss when collecting a specific title, and the Justice League being my all-time favorite comic series, the idea of a giant book filled with JLA stories filled me to no end. I was disappointed, though, to find two reprints of comics I already had, but the centerfold by Terry Austin, Dick Giordano was worth the price of admission. As far as a treasury I would like to have seen published, I second or third your Wonder Woman idea. The sadly named Harry G. Peter was an artist that is an acquired taste, but his work is so distinct that a larger format would be eye-popping with all those squiggly lines and round figures. A Flash treasury with reprints of Carmine Infantino and Irv Novik's work would have been nice to see. I know he was never a marquee character, but I would have thought a Hawkman treasury, especially if it had a Golden Age reprints by Sheldon Moldoff and Silver Age reprints by the immortal Joe Kubert, I think both these artists would have translated well to the larger format. A treasury featuring Jim Aparo's work from Brave and the Bold would have taken the dollar out of my pocket, as would a treasury featuring Silver Age Gil Kane and Bronze Age Joe Staton's Green Lantern. The one treasury I would like to see above all others would be a reprinting of the Justice Society origin from DC Special number 29. The Neil Adams cover and the interior work by Joe Staton and Bob Layton, as well as the story by Paul Levitz, would be a genuine treat to this old fanboy. Sorry for the rambling mess of a letter. Keep up the great work, and thank you very much, Russell Rosenkill. Well, thank you, Russell. Thank you for all those comments. I appreciate the binge listening. Thank you for getting through the G.I. Joe Transformers episodes. I had trouble with the Transformers one myself because, yeah, Transformers. Yeah, I mean, agree to everything you just said, especially, boy, the JSA origin from DC Special 29. That's in a digest, of course. It was reprinted there, but they never did it as a treasury. That would have been really, really beautiful. Again, the Neil Adams cover and the State and Layton artwork would have been great. So, again, thank you for finding the show, and I hope you enjoyed this episode as well. So that is going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. Thanks so much to my pal Chuck Dill for stopping by. It was great to finally get a chance to talk to him in real life and talking about Shazam. Let us know what you thought of this episode, of course, on our website, findwaterpodcast.com, and that's where you can find all the back episodes of the show. You can subscribe to Treasury Cast on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking treasuries over on Twitter at Treasury Comics. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be named checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pollier and Brett Young for their support of Treasury Cast. I very much appreciate it. So that is going to do it. Again, thanks everybody for listening. We will see you next month, but until then, go big or go home.
Hi. Today you saw why everyone should be given a chance to prove his or her abilities. Don't put someone down just because they're different from you. And don't put a girl down just because she's a girl. When a person's talents are wasted, it's a loss to all of us. See you next week.